Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Behind Massive Screens, a game development podcast here from Massive Entertainment in Malmo, Sweden. Before we get to our esteemed guest who's here with us today, I just want to introduce my new co-host here at BMS, Dori Halldórsson. I've been rehearsing.
It's close. You're not quite there, but... We'll get there. But yeah, my name is Dori Halldórsson, and I recently joined the content team here at Massive, and, you know, been working behind the scenes, editing and working on the podcast. And I think after about like my 20th email to Petter...
And 150th team message.
Yeah, where I was like, maybe next time, why don't you ask about something like this? And then I finally broke him down and he said, hey, why don't you just co-host... and bring your flavor to the podcast. So no pressure.
Yeah, stop mailing me, just show up.
Yeah, but yeah, excited. I mean, I've been spending over a decade on the other side of gaming in the media. So I would like to think that I have a certain point of view of stuff that I would like to know about developers, not just, you know, the actual games and making of the games, but also the actual personalities, the people that make the games, which I want to get to. So,
and that's what we are going to get to. I'm just going to add real quick. We used to work together 11 years ago. Dori behind the camera, me in front of the camera. And as I've said before, Dori is probably the one, besides my mother, who has stared the most at my face over the years.
Yeah, and listen to your voice again and again on the loop.
That was your job for like way too long. But
and again,
we're not the most interesting people in this room, believe it or not. It's Paula. Welcome, Paolo Hofstein, art director. I know, art producer. Couldn't even get that right. I'm really bad at titles. Art producer on The Division 2. Welcome, Paolo.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm actually going to start completely non-game related, really. Your name, Paolo.
Yes.
It's really Swedish.
Yes.
Why?
Well, so I'm from Vancouver, Canada.
Right.
However, my mother is from Sweden. My grandfather is actually from Malmo, and on both sides of my parents' family, people are variously from Sweden and Denmark.
Right.
So I had a connection to this region long before I got here, and grew up in a household where people spoke Swedish and Danish and were very Scandinavian, and Fika was very important.
Fika
and,
is always important.
Yeah. You know. But interestingly, I was the only one in my household and among all the relatives that was born in Canada, and I'm the only one that's here now.
Right. How did that feel then, coming to Malmo with your grandfather from here?
It was really interesting. Like I was going to go to Copenhagen. I thought I'll go over to Malmo because it's where my grandfather's from. I was really curious, and I really fell in love with the city.
Yeah,
and I felt very at home here in a way that I'm not used to when I'm traveling. I mean, I love going everywhere. I love traveling, but you know, I guess maybe just being raised in a household of people from this region, that the everything here just felt incredibly normal to me in a way that I'm not used to. I'm in a country I've never been in before,
right?
You know, so that was fun, and you know, and after a couple of visits, I mean, I'd been with Ubisoft for a while in a different studio in Germany in Mainz. You know, I thought, well, there is a studio in Malmo, Ubisoft studio. They're working on a franchise I'm a fan of,
right?
You know, so maybe I can find some way to negotiate working up in Malmo.
Right. Yeah, relatively speaking, I mean, Malmo is a fairly, it's a large city in Sweden terms, or in the Swedish context, but in the world, it's really small.
It's tiny compared to Vancouver. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
How many people live in Vancouver?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard because
more than Malmo.
Yeah. I mean, it's a city surrounded by lots of other cities that is ultimately one big city. But they all count their population separately. So I don't know, but it's probably, I guess, in around 3-4 million people in the area.
Yeah, that's quite the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how did you end up in... this is quite a long story, I know, which is awesome. But let's just start out with how you ended up in the industry, because your entire journey now, so far, in the industry has led you here to Massive and to Malmo, where we started this entire conversation. But how... Where did it start?
Yeah, I mean, I had a bit of an unusual entry into the industry in that I never planned to be in it, and I didn't get into it until I was about 30 years old.
Right.
Despite the fact that, you know, as a teenager, I played games religiously, you know, and on my Commodore 64 and my Amiga and hacked them to pieces to learn how games were made, how games worked. And yet it never occurred to me that this could be something I would do for a living.
Right.
And, you know, I spent a lot of my 20s bouncing around the film industry. And the film industry is fun as hell. Like the game industry, it's a lot of work and there's a lot of long hours and there's a lot of craziness. But it was enjoyable. But I could not get meaningful work. I was doing what they call production assistant work, which is low-paying, bottom-of-the-ladder kind of stuff.
Yeah, the competition must be insane.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to do anything meaningful in the industry, I'm going to need to get a bit of an education. So I took a teaching gig for a while because it paid well. And went to a place called Vancouver Film School, which is now also known for its gaming program, but at the time it was just film. And, you know, I studied film and directing and writing and editing, and, you know, I was going to be the next Ridley Scott and take on Hollywood and make awesome science fiction movies and so forth. But obviously that's not quite what happened, other than making a couple, you know, short indie films. A friend of mine who worked briefly in the game industry started his own game company called Mad Genius Software. He found a couple guys that were building their own game engine. This was in the days of Duke Nukem and Doom, you know, so 3D engines were pretty simple. And these guys had one that could do things that no one else's engine could do at that time, with animated textures and big outdoor spaces. So what they were doing was pretty cool. And I'd been making Doom WOTS. I'd been playing around with, you know, just making my own maps in Doom. And so I kind of bugged these guys, like, can I help you? You know, they got an office, they got some money. And so they brought me in. They didn't know what to do with me. They thought, well, he's a filmmaker. He can help with cutscenes. They weren't even remotely ready for cutscenes because they were just starting out the game. So I started playing around with their level editor and I started making levels. They're making maps. And I was good at it. And so they let me continue doing that, you know, and this was in an era where you could make a first person shooter, which is what we made, with 20 people. I mean, how many people were on Division 2 at peak? 1,000 maybe? Yeah, I don't know. There was 20 of us and we made this game and you had to wear a lot of hats. So I was the, you know, level designer and I also made textures and I did some scripting and I answered the phone and I went to conferences and handed out t-shirts at E3. Like you just do everything, right?
Sure.
You know, and so we made this game and, you know, we worked our asses off and did some crazy hours. And after 2 years, we put it out there and were absolutely destroyed by a game you may have heard of called Quake that came out just before us. Yeah. And we went bankrupt and that was the end of us. And I thought, well, that's the end of my adventure in the video game industry. Time to get back to filmmaking.
Right.
But an artist that I worked with there, he got a job with sort of a veteran game company called Backbone Entertainment. I think they were called Digital Eclipse at the time. And they were working on Spyro the Dragon games for Game Boy and stuff. And they needed a level designer. And so this guy recommended me. And so I went over for an interview and the guy didn't want to interview me. He was like, he asked me about, you know, Commodore 64 games. And then he said, let's go drink tequila. He was really into like fancy tequilas. He's like, I can taste the difference between like a $20 tequila and a $30 tequila. Can you? He was really interested in if I could do this.
It's a very valid interview question.
Absolutely. Right? And I guess I did well because at the end of the night, he was like, can you start tomorrow?
Well,
it was a bit of a different era. I mean, this was a long time
ago. It sounds very much like how I thought of the video game industry back in the day.
Yeah, that was how it worked for you, right?
Yeah.
Just a couple of months ago, drinking tequila on a bar.
But I also got a job in Denmark, so it was beer.
That's...
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, Canada, known for its tequila. the thing is, I mean, I've been in the game industry ever since.
Right.
So I guess the film industry thing didn't actually work out, but that's okay.
That's okay. You can always go back to the film industry. Don't leave us.
Yeah.
Let's not go down that path.
I, I could, but, you know, it kind of occurred to me after a while that I just like storytelling and I like visual storytelling. I mean, I could have ended up in games or film or comic books.
Right.
And I think it would have been equally happy in any of these things because they touch on the things that I enjoy doing.
Yeah. And I think that's quite interesting. Like, I come from the film industry myself, hence why I'm still filming and editing. But there's one difference between, like you mentioned, there are comic books and films and games. Is games is the only one that's interactive, where the person consuming the entertainment is also the person creating it at the same time.
Absolutely.
So the extra effort as a creator creating the media of giving the freedom or giving them the perspective to actually be able to create their own entertainment. That must add like a whole new dimension.
Absolutely, because we're working as storytellers, enabling other people to become their own storytellers. And those are the kind of games I really like working on. I don't like working on heavily scripted games. I like games where the players can run around and kind of figure out what they want to do and how they want to do it. So I'm, you know, really happy to be working on a big open world title that gives players a lot of freedom because they're, you know, basically able to tell their own stories, you know, to themselves in a way that is comfortable for them.
Yeah. Right. And I mean, another part of that is also the layer of storytelling that is told through the environment. Like in film, of course, with sets and stuff, you add in a feeling of this place. But in games, it's often something hidden off to the side where you find it and then you're kind of imagining the story of how everything got to.
Yeah, I mean, and I absolutely love this stuff. I mean, one of the things I really like about, you know, my current title, Division 2, is the level of detail of world building that we do. It's fun. It is layers of storytelling. So while, you know, the game has, okay, here's a story, you need to go from here to here and do this thing. If you stop and look around, you will see all of these events that happened or that you can kind of figure out what probably happened here based on things like, you know, just scarring in the world or graffiti or, you know, trash or just, you know, blood, whatever it is that we put in the world. And, you know, and we do this on the objects, we do it on the clothing, pretty much everything we put in the world has a story. You know, and I cannot stand it when I see a game and everything looks like it's brand new, that it came off the assembly line, because nothing in the real world looks that way. And, you know, and we spend a lot of time thinking about how worn should this be, how torn up should it be, how dirty should it be, for everything we put into the game. Because, again, that is another layer of storytelling. And it's a kind of storytelling that I really love doing. And I know for some players, they're just going to run around and they'll just, you know, not focus on that, but I know there's some that stop and, you know, zoom in and check out the details. And I love making content for those players.
Yeah. And even the ones that are not paying attention to it subliminally, they will get an extra
absolutely
feeling.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I saw a kind of a critique or a comparison between two of my favorite games, Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas. Mm. And they were kind of the thesis was why Fallout New Vegas is a more immersive world. And the main question that I thought, like, what do these people eat?
Right.
And then they just went through, it's like, in Fallout New Vegas, you can see farms, you can see, like, they're actually, these are actually habitats, not just houses. And that's, like, always stuck with me. Like, and ever since, whenever I play a game, I'm like, okay, so how does life actually work outside of this mission that I'm on?
Right, and that's something we really try to convey, because even though the situation in New York and Washington in our game is very, very bad, there's still people making things function, right? And we put a lot of focus on making sure that what they're doing makes sense. It's stuff that would actually work in order to keep people fed, to keep people housed, to keep people clothed. And for me, one of the things that's really important about The Division as a franchise is the layer of hope always has to be there. Mm-hmm. Always. We're not a dystopia. Mm. We're a game about hope.
Right. Yeah. And moving forward and trying to reach a
yes.
A good
things are bending, but they're not completely broken yet. Yeah. And that's kind of the line we like to ride in the game.
Right. One question, though, about I'm stepping away a little bit from The Division and more into your background again. Mm-hmm. And the world building. Looking at what we can do now in AAA, these huge, like huge worlds, especially here at Ubisoft and Massive, where we work very much with this big, fantastic, and we have so much room for as you talked about, environmental storytelling and stuff like that. But is there anything you missed from the, like, working on an FPS with 20 people, the kind of world building you'd have to do within? Is there any charm that you miss from that, or is it just
not good, not really? I mean, I kind of miss your hands-on level design a little bit every once in a while. Once you get into management, actually doing, you know, what I think of as the real work becomes something you don't get to do too often, you know. But I wouldn't go back.
No, if just I don't think anybody would. But kind of the, if you're looking at Quake is. It's very in your face with all the demons and all the pentagrams and stuff. But still, if there was something there in the way you had to be creative to tell these stories back then, the answer might just be no, thanks, never again.
Yeah, again, I don't know if I even missed that part of it, because a lot of those games don't even really make a whole lot of sense if you look at them carefully.
That's true.
And they could only have so much content, and so a lot of it had to be very impactful and very kind of on the nose. You know, and patient storytelling wasn't a thing that was really even an option for them back then. But based on, you know, what I like to do and what interests me, what we can do now is much more of a suitable environment for me, because I like those layers. I like the depth.
Yeah.
You know, and I like stories that can unfold at different speeds based on how the player, you know, wants them to.
Yeah.
More than just demon there, kill.
Yeah.
I'm getting horrible flashbacks to procedurally generated dungeons in like Daggerfall when it comes to environmental storytelling and pacing and stuff. Like, what the heck is going on?
And procedurals, you know, design is really interesting to me. I mean, I really want to see where it goes. I don't think it will ever completely take over handcrafted stuff, but I do think there's going to be a space for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Most definitely.
Yeah, I'm going to let my ADD kick in slightly here and completely change the subject, because there's a question that I'd like to ask my filmmaker friends, like when I first meet them, which is normally like, what is your first memory of watching a movie? Not what's the first movie that you saw, but like, what's your first memory? So to you, what is your first gaming memory? Not the first game you played, but the first, like, it stuck with you, like, oh, games.
All right. I mean, I'm really old. So like anyone my age, I can usually reference Pong as being my first, you know, memory, you know, the table tennis game that we had in our black and white TV.
The OG.
You know, so I guess that's it. But, you know, when I think about what I do now for a living, in some ways it doesn't really feel like it was that first step, because it was a digital version of a basic, you know, reflex game. You know, I always think of Space Invaders as the first real video game, because it had mechanics that just couldn't exist any other way. And just little things like having to shoot up through your defensive barriers as a way to get additional offense was a game design choice, an interesting one. And for me, in the history of video games, maybe the first really interesting game design choice that couldn't exist outside of video games.
Yeah, an extra mechanic that actually defined it as a separate art form rather than an imitation of a real world company.
And I first played it on a Commodore PET in my high school computer class, and you know, and it just really struck me as such an interesting idea. So I kind of just started thinking about games a lot more after that. And I mean, I guess that's part of why I'm here now. The tendency to kind of parse it out and try to figure out how things work.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that, you know, you used to do mods and hacks back in the day. Like, what sort of was it? Environmental mods then, or like computer?
I remember there was a game called Boulder Dash that had a level editor. And I made a ton of levels for it. I just found it fascinating. And back then, you could share levels with the BBS systems. And with other Commodore 64 players. And a couple of years ago, I saw somebody had taken that game in an emulator and had all of these, you know, fan-made levels in it. And my levels were still in there.
Oh, nice. Like,
30 years later.
Nice.
So it was kind of neat. I couldn't get the emulator to run, though. So I couldn't look at my old levels. Oh, well.
Well, what was it like moving from hacking C64 games and stuff to moving into Doom? Moving into modding 3D space in that way?
I mean, for me, it was fun because Doom was such a visceral experience, and it was mm-hmm. and it was a, you know, for me it was a multiplayer experience, and you know, and the chance to make stuff and get immediate feedback from people I know on it, mm-hmm. and instant critiquing of it, and you know, among my friends who did the same thing, we got really competitive about it really fast. Who could be the best at this kind of thing? And for me, that part of it was really fun. And that was maybe my first real taste of, you know, what I do now, which is make stuff and then just put it out there and wait to hear what people, you know, have to say about it, good or bad.
Yeah, I did a bunch of modding in Duke Nukem 3D when they released that editor. That was a lot of fun. Now, listening to you, I kind of wish I'd stuck with it for more than a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'm also having flashbacks of modding GTA 1. Editing the sprites.
Sitting in paint, just adding stuff? Yeah, Oh, that's awesome. We did that with Civilization 2. Nice. That was really easy, and it was really easy to cheat if you just went into the inner files. Great find. Highly recommended. But how was it? You came from Vancouver,
yep.
as you said, and then you also mentioned that you worked at Ubisoft Mainz in Germany.
Yep.
What was it like moving from Vancouver to here? Why did you move from Vancouver?
Yeah, I mean, I'd been in the game industry in Vancouver for, I guess, over a decade. Mm-hmm. Bounced around a couple different companies, worked at places like EA Sports and so forth. The Vancouver AAA game industry kind of dried up at a certain point. It didn't completely disappear, but it became a lot tougher. There was a change in government and government policies that meant that some of the incentives and tax breaks available to the game industry kind of went away. And so, you know, Rockstar left, Disney closed. There just suddenly wasn't a lot of work in AAA in Vancouver. And I dabbled in sort of mobile free-to-play stuff and decided that was not for me.
Right.
And so if I wanted to stay in AAA gaming, I needed to look outside of Vancouver. So I started looking at jobs in other parts of Canada, the United States, Europe, Asia. And as it turns out, it was Ubisoft Blue Byte in Mainz in Germany that you know, took an interest enough to fly me out there and talk to me. And I guess it went well because I flew back to Vancouver and there was a job offer waiting for me when I landed.
No, that was pretty good.
Yeah. So that was interesting. And,
so you just turned around on the way home from the airport. Oh, going back to Germany.
Oh, it was hilarious. So I got the job offer and went to talk to my wife. And we'd been together for about 20 years. But we weren't married. We'd lived together for a long time, but if you're going to take somebody to another country with you, you need a piece of paper. So I'm like, how about we go live in Germany for a while? And she's like, all right. And I'm like, we'll have to get married. And she's like, okay. And this was like, I think on a Thursday, we contacted a judge to come to our apartment who was there on the Sunday. And we had two friends as witnesses, and had this very, very short ceremony. And then my wife and I, we went on to Facebook. And at the same time, we announced to everyone in Facebook, we're moving to Germany, we're married, come drink with us at this pub. And that's how our friends and family found out.
Games industry wedding, I think. A lot of expats.
Yeah, and then 2 months later, like, give away 90% of our stuff and come to Germany. And you're asking what it's like. I mean, every country is different.
Yep.
And you find really interesting nuance to that when you live in a place rather than just visit it.
Of course.
You know, and there were challenges. There's always challenges. Moving is very, very hard at the best of times. Moving across a city is hard.
Yeah.
Changing continents is something else, you know, but it's also really exciting. And it's really rewarding. It's really interesting, you know. And I went from, you know, a very big modern, you know, metropolitan city to, you know, kind of a large medieval town full of 1,000-year-old buildings and old churches, you know, on the Rhine.
It's like Ed Izzard says, "Welcome to Europe. This is where history comes from."
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and just the way of life was just so different, and. Yeah, you know, but also, you know, language barriers and cultural barriers. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many things about expectations, body language that are different. For me, the big one, I always warn people, how cultures deal with conflict resolution is very different in every country, right? You have to learn this stuff if you're going to actually function.
Did you notice not only, of course, culturally moving to a different country, but also in kind of comparing away the industry in the US and Europe?
I mean, working in Canada is a lot like working in the United States for the most part. So the game industry there is famous for some pretty brutal work hours. Crunch is fairly common. I did some astonishing hours at my time in Vancouver. And it was just part of the landscape there. It was just, if you were in the game industry, you worked some heavy hours. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of instability. It was very easy to just, show up at work one day and go, oh, there's been a round of layoffs.
Yeah.
It would come in the email. You're like, oh, grab your stuff. Yeah. Get out now.
Yeah, there are a lot of horror stories.
And when I was in Germany, and the one time I suggested that maybe I would need some people on my team to, stay until 8 o'clock. And the studio manager was like, no, we're not doing that. We can delay the launch. I'm like, all right. It's just such a different mindset.
Sure.
About, the protection of personal time is much more important, I find, in Europe. Mm-hmm. And and I'm sure many North Americans who've moved to Europe can testify to this, it is hard to adjust to.
Because it's so ingrained?
It's so ingrained, yeah. So if I'm not feeling well, then I'm going to stay home today. I'm not feeling well. The guilt.
Right.
Because you don't do that.
Right.
Back on the other side of the pond, right? So it takes a while to untrain that emotional response to it.
Sure.
Yeah, I can. It's interesting because, people here are much more protective of their free time. There's a lot more regulations in place to make these things manageable. But it doesn't stop, European countries from producing a lot of product.
Right. Sure.
And, so that was really interesting. Another thing that I really found is that, and I don't think this is going to be true through all of Europe, but certainly in Scandinavia and in Germany, there's a lot more negotiation in problem solving. Mm-hmm. It's much more hierarchical back in Vancouver. So, if somebody is the boss, if they're the senior producer, they're creative director, and they say, okay, guys, this is what we're going to do, then everyone does it. And here that's not necessarily the case. You actually have to convince people that your idea makes sense or nothing happens, and that's very different from what I'm used to. And for me, it's just really one of the positives about working here. There's so much emphasis on consensus. Let's get everyone on board.
Right.
And it means you kind of have to do your homework on whatever ideas you have to really sell it to people. And I think that's really good.
Yeah. So how was coming to Ubisoft?
In some ways it was a bit of a dream come true because they'd made so many games that I really liked, and I'd never had the opportunity to work in the Canadian offices. And it was such a big company. And I mean, I'd worked for Electronic Arts, which is also a big company, but is structured very differently. And I find Ubisoft is extremely connected. Mm-hmm. So even though we're in 30 different cities, on any given day, I'm working with people in multiple cities. Even today, in addition to my team here, I'm working with people in Bucharest and Montreal and Shanghai and Pune, mm-hmm. and we're all working on the same stuff.
Right.
It means that there's a lot of people you can turn to if you need help with something, a lot of people you can turn to if you need answers for something. If you just need a little bit more people with a certain kind of know-how, there might be somebody available. So it gives you a lot of opportunities to tackle situations that would just be a closed door in a smaller office where there would just be no solution.
Right.
And I've learned that I like big projects with big teams. Coming to Ubisoft was a chance to do that, big projects that get a lot of press, that get a lot of eyeballs on them, that get a lot of pressure on them, but where you also have a lot of resources in terms of people and development dollars, is my favorite kind of game development, mm-hmm. for whatever reason. It's just where I'm comfortable. And I think Ubisoft was the first opportunity I had to work on games that were on that scale.
Right.
Okay, so you like the pressure of it.
Yes.
It helps you do better work, or
I hope so. But I enjoy it nonetheless. Yeah. For whatever reason, just big projects with a lot of attention is, I guess the expectation is part of it, but I also just find the process of working on games this big to be really interesting, you know, and the challenge is really interesting to solve. But I'm not going to lie, it is fun to launch something and see it on TV and on the news and people writing about it, and you go on social media and everyone's talking about it. It's legit fun.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah, and you're working on a live game as well, so it's a constant feed of getting new updates out there. Yep. And getting player interaction. Players are playing every day, talking. Yep. To you. You're quite active on Twitter, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I like live game. Mm-hmm. I was on, Rainbow Six Live for a while, and then now I've been in Division Live for a while. And I enjoy it. I mean, you get to roll out content on a fairly regular basis, whereas on some teams, you go years without something being put in front of the players. I've been very lucky in that I've never had to do that. Right. I've been getting content out to players regularly my whole career. And it's even when the response is not, you know, as positive as you would like, it's still interesting and it's still kind of fun.
Yep.
I do caution, it's probably not for everyone. You know, some people, when we launch stuff, they just don't look online for the reaction,
right?
Because if it's negative, it's something that's going to weigh on them a little bit. For whatever reason, it doesn't bother me that much. Some things go really well, some things go less well. Mm-hmm. You know, you take in the data, you think about it, you learn from it, and you move on.
Yep.
Yeah, but when you say it, if it's a negative, it doesn't bother you, but it's still something that you consider and take on.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So, it doesn't weigh on me emotionally is what I mean. But of course, we have to take the information and think about it and decide, okay, well, what do we do different? What do we do instead? Yeah. And, there's so many considerations with the live game. It's okay, because you can say, well, what did the players want? But there's no such thing as the players. There's different kinds of players that want different things. And we have to kind of look at all of them and see the different things that they're saying. There's the thing that the developers want to do, and that matters too. Because people need to be motivated and need to be excited about what they're doing. Ideally, you find things that the team wants to do and the players want.
Yeah, you want
to
find that
lines up.
And
the studio's okay with it, and you actually have a budget for it. You know, then it's okay, wow. we can do all the things. But the reality is it isn't always there. Sometimes you want to do something, but you don't have the time or you don't have the right personnel at that point. There's a lot of factors that go into it. There's always a million things we want to do. And what we actually can do always feels like a very small part of that. But it's a constant conversation that's always, you know, under consideration, always under adjustment, because the circumstances are constantly changing. What other games are out there is constantly changing. The talent available to us is constantly shifting. It's a very active form of design.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about kind of your day-to-day, if you will. Because, you are now on a smaller team than when Division 2 originally launched.
Yep.
And like you mentioned, when you started off, you were wearing a lot of hats. And I get the feeling that it's kind of the same.
It is a little bit, yeah. We're a smaller team now, so... When I started in Division, I had a very specific scope. And as people have rolled off onto other projects, more things have been put on my plate, which is fine. I mean, it's not always the most ideal. There are times when I wish I could, you know, hand some stuff off to another person. But it also means that you get, you know, to be in more conversations about the game than you necessarily were when it was a bigger team. For me, my day-to-day... I have a number of people that report to me, both here and who are working for me in other cities. So I try to get in pretty early before most people do to catch up on emails and remind myself what's on my plate in terms of stuff that's, you know, urgent, semi-urgent, or, you know, down the road stuff. And then the day itself, I mean, like a lot of managerial game devs, it's maybe... I'd say maybe 25-30% meetings, which is better than I think a lot of people in my situation. And the rest of my time is a combination of people pull me over and say, hey, I have a question, I have a problem, what should I do? And I help, you know, them walk through the thought process where we come up with the best solution. And I spend a chunk of my day just looking at art assets coming in and, you know, deciding, okay, is this good enough? Is this ready? If not, what feedback should I give? Is there technical feedback I should get? Who should I hand that off to? So my day is broken up by a lot of small tasks.
Yeah. Now, we had a recent podcast with concept artists, and mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about their process of how to be creative and come up with stuff. But I also wanted to hear, like, from the other side, you managing concept artists, mm-hmm. how to communicate down what you want them to communicate to the players, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, it will vary quite a bit based on the who is the initiator of the core idea of the stuff we need to do. Because sometimes, you know, game design will come to us and say, hey, we need concepts for this. You know, sometimes it's stuff that we come up with ourselves as a team conversationally. Sometimes I come up with an idea, and then, you know, I make a brief, and then I sit down with the concept artists. And I think when I present a brief, I do it mostly verbally. So I sit down with them and try to explain in my head what it is that we're trying to do, the kind of storytelling we're trying to do. I think art is always storytelling. Mm. So, you know, I think you're probably talking about the concept artists for character clothing and,
yeah.
and gear. Yeah. You know, and so we're always like, okay, who would dress this way? Why? What's the story behind this person? You know, so it gives you a kind of a reference to sort of ground your direction. Otherwise, I mean, concepting is one of those things that it can take a long time. If you have too much freedom, you can go in a lot of different areas. So often the first thing you want to do is kind of narrow down your scope to some important specifics and then iterate on those. So for me, it's, yeah, I try to sell them on the kind of storytelling we're doing. And then once they get started, then of course it's sort of a normal back and forth where they show me stuff. And if I think it's not quite in the right direction, then again, we talk about it and I suggest why I think it's drifting in a different way than we were expecting or would like at this time. And I mean, that's pretty much it. Yeah,
if you want to listen to that particular episode Dory is talking about, it's the episode just before this one in the feed. So we interviewed Marie and Toppy, and then we brought in their boss.
Do they say bad things about me?
No,
they
say, you'll have to listen to find out.
Exactly. Did they cry?
Afterwards.
Okay.
They did. Yeah. Not on tape. No, they didn't. It was a really good discussion. You were talking about who is this person and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Marie, who was in that episode, comes from a fashion background, mm-hmm. kind of how the fashion industry looks the other way. It's not, she explained that here we look at who would dress and then you go to create the clothes, and fashion industry is kind of the other way around. Here's the product, who will actually wear this, and then go from there. There's a really interesting discussion from Marie. She had a lot of insights into that. So go listen to that episode if you haven't already.
Yeah. But I also, I mean, because we want to dive a little bit more into like who you are,
mm-hmm.
rather than just your job, which of course is a big part of, like, I feel like my job is a big part of me, but there is a life outside of job. So what do you like to do in your freedom? Do you have like hobbies that you like to?
Yeah. I mean, I have less hobbies than I used to. I mean, I used to make music, and that seems to have stopped for a long time now. I used to draw, I used to write. Those things seem to have stopped. I'd say generally when I think of what do I do when I have the real option with my free time, my favorite thing in the world to do is travel. I absolutely adore travel. And there isn't a part of the planet that I don't want to see personally. And my favorite thing to do in the world is probably to explore a city I've never been in before on foot. Just walk around and look at everything and soak it in and look at the layers of history and the architecture and look at the way that people's lives there will be functionally different because of the way the cities are set up and look at the differences in terms of the way people decorate their world and go into bars and cafes and talk with the locals. This is probably what inspires me more than anything else, and I get a charge from it. And when I'm at work and I'm feeling charged, it's usually because I've just come back from a trip.
Yeah, I was just about to say that sounds very interestingly like it is part of the job. Like,
yeah, and I think for what I do, I mean, I think, you know, you also have to kind of be current, right? So if I'm going to make clothing, I need to know what are people wearing and really look at it. Like, how are they assembling things? How are these things actually pieced together? How are people choosing to arrange their appearance in the world? You know, and again, how do people decorate their personal spaces? And, you know, I think to work in art, you have to be a sponge that is always taking in new information. And so whether I'm walking around a city or watching a movie or music videos, I'm always asking, you know, questions about trends in the way people operate in the world and how it might be something that we can sort of reflect back on the world in the work that we do.
I have a lot of questions to the kids these days who's decided, at least in Sweden, to dress the way we did in the 90s. So the big question is, why? Why are you doing this? We sacrificed ourselves to wear this crap.
It's because
20-30 years ago.
It's because there was no social media back then, so the photos of us back then don't really exist, so they haven't seen how ridiculous it looks.
Ah, okay, good. You're going to suffer so much when you grow up. Yeah, see the awfulness you're wearing.
So I went to high school and college in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's a very different aesthetic.
Yeah. Want to bring it back?
Not on me, but sure. I mean, I used to frankly dress like an extra member of Duran Duran. I don't think anyone wants to see me do that now.
Oh, I want to see you do that now. But what was that like then, coming to, going back to Malmo? And you just had different layers of history, the details on the city, et cetera. What was that like coming here, especially with your family history too?
Yeah, it's really interesting because, I mean, because my family was, you know, an expat family in another country where most people stayed behind here, most of my relatives were here and unknown to me. I've actually been to a family reunion in Copenhagen where I met a bunch of relatives that I'd never met before. You know, and my family names are all over the tombstones in the cemetery here. And if I wanted to, I could get like a lawyer, a doctor, and a dentist with my name because there's enough of them, you know, my family name. So that part's
that family discount.
That part's interesting. Malmo's an interesting place. Like, you know, if somebody was like on, you know, from North America or Asia or wherever outside of Europe was on their first European tour, I don't know that it would be on my list of cities to visit.
Right.
No.
We are the little sibling of Copenhagen.
Yeah. You know, but I find it interesting how in so many European cities, like you'll have like the little historical town and you'll have the, you know, the new town and these really compartmentalized spaces. And Malmo's a bit of a mess where, you know, there's just every street has buildings from, you know, 500 years ago, 100 years ago, from the 70s, you know, some horrible, brutalist thing, you know, and something new. And they're all side by side. Yeah. And so it gives it a little bit of a different character, I think, than a lot of Europe.
Yep.
And it's... I enjoy the weird rebellious nature that people in Skåne have about being Swedish but different. Because they seem to take a lot of pride in, well, we're Swedish, but we're not from Stockholm.
No, that's a big thing.
It's a very big thing.
It's kind of, we're very close to Copenhagen where Dora lives, and it's kind of the same thing between our cities. We're very close, but we're certainly not Danish and the other way around. We're allowed to do that. We love each other, but...
Yes. But I've even seen people do the... We're a little bit different because we're a little bit more Danish, but we're not Danish.
Exactly. So you give an insight into how it works, the dynamics between Copenhagen and Malmo. We complain about drunk Danes here, and they complain about drunk Swedes there.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much goes back and forth.
Yep.
But I mean, and I've been, Copenhagen is one of my favorite cities.
It's a wonderful, beautiful
city. So nice to have it so close.
Yeah. But who has the best tequila?
I'm really not Mexico, obviously. But,
true.
More of a whiskey drinker.
Okay. Fair enough. But you were a fan of the division coming here.
I was. I was. I've been a fan of Tom Clancy games for a long time. When the first Rainbow Six came out a while ago, I mean, I played it religiously and its sequels, and then discovered that some of my friends were into playing the multiplayer online. And we had a group that played these games and Counter-Strike games on every Friday night from midnight till sunrise. And this group lasted for years. And, you know, so I was just always a fan of the brand. And when I was in Blue Byte in Germany, I got an opportunity to work on Rainbow Six Siege, which was a huge thrill for me. So a chance to go back to the actual, you know, game that I loved so much and a new version of it. And while I was working on it, I remember we were looking at the launch of Division closely, because obviously another Clancy game. And it was a game that had a launch, and then through the live aspect started iterating on the game.
Yep.
And we really looked at that as an example of, you know, you can launch a game, and if there's some things that people are calling out as, you know, not quite there, we can iterate on it.
Right.
And so we very much took that as an inspiration for iterating on Rainbow Six. And while we were sort of looking at that, I started playing Division, and then I kept playing it, and I kept playing it, and I kept playing it, and I really fell in love with the game. I found it really, really compelling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so when it was time after 5 years in Germany, and my wife and I were like, Germany's been awesome, but 5 years was, you know, kind of the max of the plan. So where are we going next? You know, I was curious about Malmo because, you know, as previously mentioned, I had a family connection here and I'd been here and liked it. But I also knew that the studio here had worked on Division, a game that I loved. So, you know, the chance to come to a city I have a historical connection to that I love to work on what was probably my favorite franchise at the time. I mean, how fortunate can you feel, you know, than to get the opportunity to do that. So, you know, so at that moment where, you know, I got the call saying, yes, you're coming to Massive, I mean, I was the happiest boy in the world.
Yeah, I can imagine. And also, it seems like such a, looking at the Division and Division 2, it just sounds everything you've told me and Dory now, it just feels like such a perfect fit, because in the game, the city is so important.
It is.
And in both of the games.
And I'm a city person. I love cities. You know, I'm happy to go to the country once in a while, look at a tree and go, hey, there's a tree and a mountain and where's my hotel?
Yep.
You know, but I love cities all over the world. I mentioned exploring cities is my favorite thing to do. And in some ways, Division was one of the few games I've played that really kind of captured that essence of it oozes the city as pretty much a character in that game. It was beautifully done. And I think that's absolutely one of the reasons I loved the game.
Yeah.
Right. It's handling of the city in a way that I think very few games, I don't know if any game before Division really got it that way. And when I was looking at the level of detail put into it, I was like, oh my God, this is people doing what I've been wanting to do forever.
Right.
Yeah, I was just really, really impressed with the team.
Yeah, you can really do virtual tourism in both of the games.
Yep.
You just turn a corner, is something completely new. The way it's built on real life.
I worked on the game and I still find stuff where I'm like, have I ever seen this before? when I'm walking around the game.
Yeah, and I have to say for my part, that I think the very first images that were released for Division 2, that was the site of Air Force One where it had crashed. And when I first got there in game and I started looking around, that's when it kind of started clicking for me, like how deep the environmental storytelling goes, because it's not just, oh, here's a broken plane and we put it down here on the ground. When you look around, you can see, oh, it hit there and then it must have broken up and then this piece bounced off of there. It was like, it was very detailed and deep. Somebody thought of how the crash would have happened and not just plunk a plane down there.
And I mean most of that would have been Benedict, the art director, on the project, and I know his devotion to detail. And it shows.
That's the awkward silence that we added. Perfect. I actually think
I didn't feel awkward.
You didn't feel awkward.
No,
then we could just have it.
It was good for me. It was fine. Yeah.
Just breathe now. We'll just Leave it in then.
I can enjoy your company in silence.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, we can sit here all day if you want.
Well, at some point I'll need lunch, but.
Okay. We have George behind the microphones here. he will help us out. Paul, thank you so much for coming here today. It's been amazing.
Oh, thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah, absolute pleasure.
You are welcome back whenever you feel like
it. Oh, yeah, anytime. Yeah.
Same time tomorrow?
Yep.
Sure, why not?
Welcome to the Palace season of Behind Massive Screens. 12 episodes, one every Friday. Look forward to it.
All right.
No, but thank you very much. And I also, that's the first one. Thank you, Dory. It's been wonderful. You'll be back.
Yeah. I mean, if you enjoyed my presence, make sure, of course, to like and subscribe and all that. If the numbers go up, I'll be here next time.
Do I have to do that?
Please.
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Please. Yeah. Every vote counts.
Exactly. Please. Why not?
But yeah, thank you so much. And see you next time.
For the audio, we're waving at the camera. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.